Hello and welcome to another episode of the Challenger Cities podcast with me, Ian Montgomery. This episode, I have someone I really, really admire and I'm kind of not jealous, but fascinated by the work that he does. He's Stephen Painter. He's from Gensler, the world's biggest architecture firm. I've been privileged to sort of see a little bit of their work over the years, a good friend, leads a lot of their PR. And what Stephen's kind of famous for is the work that Gensler's done around office to residential conversion. This kind of started pre-COVID. Some cities were starting to see, hang on, we have a large amount of office vacancies. And what can we do with these buildings? Can we turn them into something else? Can we turn them into residential, especially in relation to having a housing shortage? Makes a lot of sense. I've been able to see this from cities that I've worked in. So I've done a lot of work in Toronto. Used to live in Toronto. I've done a lot of work in Calgary over the years. And Calgary was kind of a bit of a canary in the coal mine for this. And again, they've done a lot of great work there. In this episode, we're going to talk about office to residential conversion, what it is, why it's needed, why it works, where it works, how Gensler have done that really, really well. We'll talk about various cities and some examples. It leads us into things like downtown renewals, and then some of the bigger urban planning lessons and considerations. So Stephen's fantastic. He really does sort of speak very, very well on this. And what I really appreciate is actually just being able to do this in a tone that is understandable. Like, we can have a conversation in the pub about this as much as we can have a conversation. Well, we can't. Stephen has had conversations with the White House about this. Without further ado, let's get into this great conversation with Stephen Painter from Gensler, starting off all about office to residential conversions and then turning into how we make great, brilliant, wonderful cities and downtowns. Enjoy. Thanks for having a chat with me. I actually had the pleasure of doing another podcast with someone from Gensler this week. So I'm going to, like, at the end of this, test to see, like, who's the better Gensler representative, you or Phil?
And then we managed to pick up two British Gensler people as well, which is pretty impressive.
All the people I know at Gensler are British. Maybe it's just me. Maybe I just sort of attract people who've left the UK and now live in Canada.
Very cool.
But you're one of the first people I met from Gensler, but we sort of chatted about stations many years ago.
Yeah,
but you're kind of more famous for commercial to residential. So I'd love to, like, rather than me bastardize that intro, like, tell me a bit more about Stephen Gensler and what you do.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm Stephen Painter. I'm building transformation and adaptive reuse leader for Gensler globally. So working on what we do with our existing buildings and our existing infrastructure all around the world. What I'm famous for, as you said, is about 5 years ago now, we were sat down doing some planning. What are we going to do? What kind of businesses do we want to get into? Where are the opportunities? And we started thinking about office to residential conversions. And this was 2019, but there was already this kind of growing idea of there are some buildings that are really end of life that people aren't interested in. You know, stuff that was built 40 years before the internet was invented. What are we doing with those office buildings? So we started looking at it, and it quickly became clear that some of our clients had looked at it and been really successful, but a lot of them had looked at it and spent months on it and spent a lot of money on it and couldn't get to a good answer. Couldn't get to the answer of, like, should I do this or not? So we wanted to answer that question. It was really a case of, okay, assuming that all of the architects working on these projects are of equal ability and all of the clients are of, you know, equal intelligence, why are some projects happening and some aren't? And that had to be to do with the buildings themselves. It had to be to do with the cities they were in. It had to be to do with that kind of, some of the intangible design stuff, but really a lot of the data of them. So that's the approach we took. Can I take a building, an existing office building, break it down into data on the physical aspects of the building and the location and the market that it's in? And can I compare that data set to a successful residential project? And if I can, I can identify the gap between the two, and that gap would have a value. And the bigger that value is, the bigger the gap, the less chance the project has of working. The smaller the gap, the better chance. So it seemed easy. After a bit of work, we managed to figure out, yeah, actually, it is. Like, the data is there. The information is there. We have projects that work and projects that don't work. We can do that comparison. And we're very quickly able to scale it up from, you know, a good idea to a couple of hundred buildings, and from a couple of hundred buildings to a couple of thousand buildings. And that's where we are now. Studied nearly 2,000 buildings across about 150 cities, built half a dozen projects, have another dozen in the pipeline as well. And we've been influencing city, state, and federal policy to encourage housing creation, encourage adaptive reuse. And we've been kind of writing that policy, supporting that policy across the US and Canada for 4 years now.
You started this before, in 2019, so before the pandemic hit, before like the whole work from home thing really boomed.
Yeah.
And I guess there was, I think about that time of I was living and working in Toronto, but doing a lot of client work in Calgary. And Calgary was probably sort of the canary in the coal mine for cities that were too reliant on commercial. I love moaning about Calgary because I have a few people that trigger with it. But I always say that Calgary is like as a city just feels a bit sad because it sucks people into downtown for the 9 to 5 and then they all leave and it feels quiet. Yeah. It feels a bit empty. That's changing now partly because of this stuff. But like, were there certain cities where you saw this coming that then it, before the pandemic and now it was a sort of good early warning signal to how to apply it in a new environment for cities?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not always a full city, actually. You know, some of it's neighborhoods in certain cities, but you're right, Calgary was the canary in the coal mine for this. They going into 2008 and then through to 2015, they were slowly losing their industry downtown. The energy sector was moving out or downsizing, so their vacancy in office buildings had got up to around 36%. That was pre-COVID.
I feel like Toronto was about 2 at the time or something.
Yeah,
like
it was 2.5.
Yeah.
Which is, probably not enough vacancy to have a liquid market, but Calgary's was certainly way too much. And you could go and rent an office space in Calgary for almost no money, and all the furniture would be there. And, often you go into all these buildings and there was like cups in the cupboard and rotten food in the fridge still, because one day the previous tenant just walked out. So the city had been working on an idea of what they do with their downtown and how they reduce that vacancy and how they increase residential and kind of create this mixed-use environment. They've been working on it for a while. And when 2020 happened, they were like, oh, we really need to do this now. So they had a five-year head start, as it were. I'm not sure head start's the right word for being in a worse position, but they had this head start and they were able to act really quickly. So in our work with them, we were able to identify what the market would be able to do, and then what they wanted to achieve, which was about a 6 million square foot reduction in vacancy, and work out the financial difference between those things and then support them with their incentive program. It's had a super positive impact. The city is one of the few cities in North America with a reducing office vacancy right now. Part of that is, of course, because they're taking office buildings off the market. But 17 projects are currently going through a conversion. That's about 10 or nearly 10% of all of the office space in downtown. And if you look at the University of Toronto School of Cities data, I think they're the second highest growing city in terms of downtown kind of cell phone pings. So, how many people are going into the city and how long are they spending there? They're at over 10% growth in the last year. Toronto, by contrast, is nearly 2% down. So the problem in Toronto is getting worse, not better. And the problem in Calgary is getting significantly better.
What makes a bunch of characteristics for it will work in this building, and there's things that will be tied to the building characteristics and there'll be things that are tied to the city dynamics. What are the biggest triggers really to go, this project will work versus this project won't?
Yeah, the physical pieces are interesting. It sounds super simple on the outset. If I took this building and I divided it up, could I make apartments people want to live in? You look at stuff like how far it is from the elevators to the window line. If I took my 600 square foot one bed, am I going to end up with a 60 foot long, 10 foot wide unit? No one's going to really want that. Or am I going to end up with a nice, 20 by 30 unit, which is going to have lots of natural light and be desirable? So there's simple physical characteristics like that. But then there's all of the hidden stuff. Do I have enough elevators? Depending on the market, do I have enough parking? Do I have the right ceiling heights where I can run all of the services and end up with a nice 9 foot ceiling? Or do I have such a high ceiling height, which some office buildings do, where I've got to like pay for all this extra paint of drywall to go up 15 feet that no one really cares about? So we balance all of those factors when we put the algorithm together to study this. it became a balance, and you know, most of it is kind of graded on a bell curve. Do I have a unit that is too long and narrow, or too wide and shallow, or perfect in the middle? Do I have enough ceiling height or too much ceiling height? Do I have enough parking, too much parking, you know, that I've got to pay for? Can I get a good efficient floor plate? And you know, an efficient floor plate is critical for this stuff. And all of that, of course, varies by market. I'm not going to do a project in Toronto with, you know, two parking spaces per unit, but probably do need to do that in Calgary, and I probably need to do that in almost all of Texas where we've been working as well. And so the physical bits are really, some of them are deal breakers. You know, if I can't lay out a unit that people want to live in, or in a lot of projects in Calgary, especially where there is a lot of buildings with only windows on two or three sides, do I have to make apartments with no windows? Well, that's not going to work. The actual city characteristics are then on, you know, is there a housing crisis? And it's an awful thing to say almost, but if there's a housing crisis, there's a better chance the projects are going to work. You know, take New York, for example. Post 9/11, they did 77,000 units through conversions.
Wow.
It was the first boom of that. They had a massive housing crisis. They had the opportunity to do it. Under the new City of Yes program right now, they are building dozens and dozens of these projects. Gensler alone is doing about 8,500 units in New York through conversion, and big projects too. You know, 1,500 units of building kind of projects. That's because the value of housing there is so high, and that they have a office vacancy problem, and they have city policies that are encouraging it. So from a city point of view, you need that demand for housing. You need a depressed office stock, and you need a city that is going to be really proactive in encouraging not just conversions, but like the creation of housing. Mm-hmm. You know, do they have policies in place that allow you to build stuff?
Well, I feel that's the thing that like people love to go and bash New York because they can't build it. Like everything takes a long time. I guess you can persevere with that bureaucracy because the valuations are so high. But it's kind of interesting to hear. Like I feel that the line at the moment you'll hear a lot is, "Oh, New York can't do this," blah blah blah. But actually, the numbers you just quoted are gigantic, and it gives you, maybe they're not gigantic in the scheme of how New York is a big city, but it still gives you hope that these things can be done.
Yeah, and New York's become very proactive about housing creation, and you know, not just New York and a lot of other cities, they actually like the conversion program because you're not building something net new. Mm-hmm. You're going into a community and changing the use of a building from predominantly empty office. You're putting people in there, but from an impact, community impact point of view, your neighbors are seeing the same building. They're not getting as disrupted by construction. They're not, you know, worried about what the design is going to look like because the building's there. So these projects are easier to pull off from a kind of NIMBY point of view than a big ground up construction project would be.
Is there a bit of a trendy element to this where I imagine certain apartment flows don't necessarily quite work in a commercial tower or a commercial building? Like if you gave a child and said, go draw me an apartment building, they'd probably draw something with balconies. And if they drew something that was an office building, they would draw it without them. I feel there's sort of tropes that we're used to, but there must be something quite desirable about a slightly awkward floor plan in a building that looks and feels a bit different to the usual residential tower in the sky.
Yeah, I think if you get it right, you can really take advantages of the benefits of an office, which is quite often, you know, grand lobbies, good location, good ceiling heights. And it's very similar to, you know, the trend, especially that we saw in Toronto 10 years ago, maybe a bit longer, where we're converting all these old factory buildings into lofts, and you had the exposed brick and beam, and you know, had the high ceilings and that kind of stuff. And you did sometimes get slightly awkward layouts, but it was offset by, you know, how beautiful they were. And you could hear everything that your neighbors were doing all the time, but it, you know, the buildings are beautiful, and they still get a premium. And we're seeing the same with these office conversions. Yes, you might get a slightly more constrained layout, but you're going to get this huge, beautiful stone-clad lobby that's been there for 20 years. In some cases, you're going to get this really beautiful heritage facade. You're going to get to be in the middle of downtown with the best transit connection and the best ability to walk to work of any place in the city. And, you know, there's an advantage to those things.
Do you have like a project or two that, like, you know what, that's my favorite one? That's the one that's the most interesting one, or that was the most difficult one to do, but it's really worthwhile as persevering on?
Yeah, I think there's a couple. We relatively recently finished Rivermark Center in Baton Rouge, and that is a kind of 60s brutalist concrete clad building. And from the outside, you really wouldn't be able to tell that much of a difference. We did remove some of the cast in place concrete on the facade, but it looks like this kind of still this brutalist office tower. On the inside, it looks incredible. You know, the punched windows are actually really big. The ceiling's super high and exposed kind of concrete waffle slab. And the units in there are incredible. So I love that contrast because you see from the outside this, you know, a completely different look and a completely different feel to what you actually get when you're in the. So I think that one's super interesting. I also think Pearl House, which we did in New York in the Financial District, finished early this year. It is, you know, one of the most difficult buildings from a layout point of view. It's a side core building. It's quite deep floor plan. It's on a really narrow street on Water Street. But being able to get creative with the way the units are laid out in there and the shapes of the units, being able to kind of free plan them because there are no structural walls on the floor, allowed us to create something that I think is pretty special. And then, you know, the amenity package, the ground floor, the rooftop. You know, if you go on the rooftop up there, you can see both the rivers and you can see the Statue of Liberty in the, you know, in the distance. It's unreal. And you know, that's been a very popular building for people to go and rent in because of that, because it is in this kind of slightly interesting neighborhood. It does have those better ceiling heights and it's in a location that people really want to be in.
That bit in New York's really interesting because I remember when I worked for a company, we had a WeWork space there, but the WeWork was at 25 Broadway. It was actually one of the cheaper WeWorks you could have.
Yeah.
Because FIDI kind of, a lot of the stuff from FIDI moved up to Midtown. So the bankers that you would see in FIDI always had like quite a boxy, ugly brown suit on because they weren't like the sort of high flying ones.
Yeah.
But then like, obviously then everything's transitioned back down there, or a lot of things have transitioned back down there because there's assets like that you can turn into something really interesting when you reimagine it.
Yeah. And it's actually, the one that we did is actually attached to a kind of sister building that was converted about 10 years ago under the first wave of office conversions. FIDI is super interesting. It is, you know, you try and go out and find dinner there at like 8 o'clock on a Friday and everything is closed,
Yeah. Which
is kind of weird. But actually, you know, there's a new Eataly down there. There's a lot of new shops and restaurants. There is some really interesting bars. Like last time I was there, I walked into a bar on like a Tuesday and there was an opera singer in there. It's like this tiny 20 person bar and the opera singer was so loud that everyone was like, you know, stuck against the wall. But that kind of urban renewal is happening down there and it makes for interesting places to live. It makes, you know, it makes for a pretty interesting neighborhood as well.
There was a tale of like sort of two taverns. I think it's like the Dead Rabbit, which was often named the best bar in the world.
Yeah.
And it's a great bar. And then there's another, we go there sometimes, but there's a bar called the, I think it's called the White Horse Tavern, and it's a dump, but it's such an enjoyable like dump to go and have a few drinks in. And yeah. I kind of love that bit of New York still has like the sort of the cheap and the fancy together.
Yeah, and that like urban renewal cycle happens so quickly and so into such an extreme in New York compared to most other cities. It, you know, it's always a pretty incredible place to be. But we're seeing that now in other cities that we're working in, you know, doing some work in Atlanta, for example, and that is going through this urban renewal cycle as business kind of moves from downtown to midtown and out of the city. But they have a huge population growth, so that's driving housing creation in areas that businesses are vacated. So you get this good mix of historic uses, new things coming in, some cheap areas where you can create something special. And actually helping cities to do that is something I've become really passionate about. Conversions is part of that. But like, really, it is about downtown vibrancy and urban renewal more than it is about just doing one project at a time.
I want to come back to Baton Rouge a little bit. I've never been there. But I think there's something, and to your point about downtown vibrancy, there's something really, really interesting about second and third tier American cities. They're downtowns where you drove downtown, you parked in an abundant surface parking lot, walked into an office building and you left. And there might be a steakhouse for when there's a business deal. Or a celebration or a retirement party or something. But like that was, I'm maybe being a bit harsh, but like a lot of American downtowns were like that. And I now feel like the last 10 years you go to certain American cities, I think Fort Worth's a really interesting example. is often sort of like the little cousin to that. Like Dallas gets the attention and sees more of the wealth, but like Fort Worth downtown is really interesting to me. But like I've been to sort of certain places and like this could be so cool, but it needs a signature project or two to really sort of pull it together. So I just want to go to Baton Rouge, but like, and I looked up that building as you were talking to me, like, oh boy, that is an ugly, brutalist building, but it's also kind of cool.
Yeah, it is. It's very cool. I've been doing a lot of this work with different cities, and we're doing some work with HUD in Federal Department of Housing in the U.S. right now. We've been doing for the last year, so I've got to go to all of these second and third class U.S. cities as part of that work and working with them. You're right. They were built around commuting in from the suburbs and having a purely office and parking downtown. That is over. That idea of that kind of city is over. And when people ask me why Europe has bounced back post-COVID so much better, and Scandinavia and that as well, it's not because Europe's forcing people back into the office. It's because for centuries, the downtowns have been mixed use, and America did not, and Canada didn't build that mixed use into their downtowns. So they weren't walkable. You drove in and maybe there was one restaurant, but like there was no reason to stay afterwards. A lot of cities now, and especially those lower tier cities, are suddenly realizing that doesn't work, and we've got to switch to mixed use. We've got to bring people down here. We've got to bring businesses down here that are, support services, restaurants, grocery stores, and that kind of thing. Calgary's getting its first downtown grocery store this year. Isn't that crazy?
So weird.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up just outside London, hundreds. Every neighborhood has three of them. So yeah, it is about that, kind of adding people and switching the mixed use. And that's why I think conversions are interesting, because you can inject a mixed use project into a purely office downtown by taking what's there and converting it to something else. And not all of them convert 10% of the offices, and you've got a mixed use neighborhood. What I think becomes weird is cities that are pushing against that, and Toronto is pushing against that. If you want to build a new big project in Toronto, it has to be mixed use. But if you want to take an existing office neighborhood and turn it into mixed use, you can't. You're going to get pushback. You're going to get, even with the rule changes that have been happening recently, it is still an incredible struggle to do it.
What causes the pushback? Because I feel like I started this podcast as a little bit of I want to poke Toronto, and it's broadened out to other cities since. But like, I think you started it. You start looking at this and you kind of go, these people don't know what they're doing. And the more you dig into that, no, these people do know what they're doing, and they do care about doing the right thing. They're not bad actors. But it's like I still don't really get the why are we stuck in this way of we want mixed use, but we can't take something that exists and turn it into mixed use. Like that still rattles my brain.
Yeah, this happens a lot with different people in different places, but it's this idea of like, oh my God, if we don't protect what we have, we're going to lose all of it. And I think a distrust in the market being kind of self-correcting.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the argument for office protection in downtown Toronto, the argument was, if we don't protect office, it will all disappear. And it's like, it won't. Nothing's ever that extreme. If you don't protect office, the worst stuff will disappear and the best stuff will stay. And some of it will be replaced with new housing. Some of it will be replaced with housing through conversions. Some of it will be universities moving in and hotels coming and that kind of stuff. It will form its natural balance, and that balance will change over time. Neighborhoods will move and switch. And our cities, the best cities, are really organic like that. The second you try and protect what you have, it breaks. You get this. One of my favorite things actually is, always talking about this kind of idea of entropy in cities. If you try and, the second you try and freeze it in time, it's broken. It will just slowly get worse. If you allow it to evolve, it will slowly become better, and it will slowly change for the better. So I think we are a little protectionist in Toronto over, we were really successful. Going into COVID, we had 2.5% office vacancy. Let's not mess that up. And it's like, it's broken. We've got to mess it up now. We've got to change the way we're doing it.
But there's something interesting about that some of those American cities, you see photos of them from like the 30s or 40s, and they had a vibrant downtown. And then the car and the sprawl sort of killed it. But now we're trying to sort of go back. And like, I feel like it's it's hard to say what to protect and what not to protect, but it's better to just sort of let things go with the flow rather than it is to sort of try and entrench it. Even if you will have some things that don't necessarily work out for the better, you'll still end up in a broadly better place.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, we can debate what the guardrails around going with the flow should be for forever.
Yeah.
But strict rules, you know, clearly don't work. And figuring out where the guardrails are is the approach we should be taking. That allows the flexibility for people to be where they want to be, for projects to happen where they need to happen, and for the, you know, the people of the city and the market in the city to react in a quick enough way to fend off these problems before they really take hold. If we'd have allowed more housing to be created in our downtown pre-COVID, we wouldn't be in a position now where we've had a vacancy rate increase of, you know, 25% in a lot of the buildings here.
Are there places where this, are there cities where you go to? I think, like, bringing back to Baton Rouge, my assumption, having not been there, would be that's a place where it'd be really hard to do this, but clearly not. Are there cities where the model doesn't work? The model says, the computer says no, effectively.
Yeah, and this is, you know, this is the next thing I'm kind of interested in tackling, and I've not in any way got my head around how we do that. As part of the study we were doing for HUD in the US, commissioned under the previous White House, obviously, but we looked at six cities around the US. We tried to pick ones that were kind of emblematic of as many different cities as possible. So, you know, a small college town and a big mega city and so on. And we're publishing that research in a couple of weeks. But what we found during that was that there are a couple of cities in the US that are facing serious population decline. And in those cities, nothing works. You know, you have an office building, you can't keep it as an office because you're getting falling rents, rising vacancy. You could convert it to residential, but you'd have to invest quite a lot of money, and the residential market is in decline because people are leaving. So what do you do with that? There are a lot. You know, Canada doesn't really suffer from this problem, or hasn't been suffering from this problem, because of high immigration rates and educated population and that kind of stuff. The US is suffering from it, and we are seeing dying cities in the US. So that, to me, is the next big challenge, is not how do you revitalize one building at a time, but how do you take a city and give it a new purpose when its purpose is left?
I feel like you have Detroit as this kind of poster child of city that reinvented itself. And Detroit's I love Detroit. I kind of love the urban decay of Detroit, but also downtown Detroit's amazing. Like how they've revitalized that is stunning.
Yeah.
But I don't necessarily know what the secret is to how they've done it. But is that the sort of thing people are looking at?
They absolutely are. And, you know, I love talking about Detroit. When they declared bankruptcy in 2013, 2014, they had a 14% office vacancy downtown.
That is 1-4.
Yeah, 1-4. That is half what the US vacancy is right now. You know? So all these other cities are in a much worse position than Detroit. And that's terrifying. Detroit went into bankruptcy because they couldn't get the tax, enough tax to pay for what they needed to do. Other cities are in the same position now. The commercial real estate tax that they were getting from these office buildings has dried up, and they are heading towards serious issues. Detroit, and whenever I talk about it, I use that stat because it scares people. And then I say, you know what happened in Detroit is they bottomed all the way out, and it was a wreck, and it is now coming back. And it's coming back for two reasons. Firstly, because everything became so cheap. You kind of make all these interesting art spaces and restaurants work because you didn't really have to pay rent and nothing costs anything. The other reason is because a couple of, you know, University of Michigan graduates came in and bought the entire city, just everything. And then they could start to build neighborhoods. They could start to focus growth in certain areas and make a collection of four or five buildings super interesting and desirable, and kind of ignore the rest of the city. So Detroit, as a city, then went around demolishing the bits that weren't desirable anymore, and the developers were focusing on the bits that were. A lot of cities we're working in don't have these kind of angel investors, and I'm not even sure that would be a good thing if they did. But cities can start to play that role. They can start to come in and say, we have a major problem. And if we take the money that we have or the tax abatement we can do and we spread it across the entire city, we're going to get nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the cities I've been talking to, as I won't name them, but they have a huge investment fund, and they worked out that they could probably replace the bins and park and street furniture across the entire city, spend a couple of hundred million dollars on it. And they said, do you think that will work? I was like, no, but who cares? If the downtown's empty and there's no restaurant to go to, what is the use of having a slightly prettier garbage can than you had before? So it becomes this thing of like, okay, where do we focus? Do we, you know, and it's very difficult to do politically, but do we ignore 70% of the city for now and we really revitalize this one neighborhood and we get people there? And then that starts to leach out. It starts to impact the next block over that suddenly is near that core neighborhood, so it becomes more desirable, and it kind of spreads. So I think that's where they really have to focus. It can't be this like spread the impact like butter, which is politically easier because every politician in the city gets a little bit of money for their ward, and it's got to be more focused. And I always come back to Calgary because they did a great job of it. They said, all right, we're going to invest this conversion money, but we're going to do it in a very limited downtown area north of the Beltline, and we're going to pick three projects around the same intersection and get those to happen, because then we'll get the grocery store and then we'll get the restaurant. And that's been successful. And I think other cities are starting to follow that. Quite a lot of cities are starting to try and follow that. And then quite a lot of other ones are saying, oh no, we can't do that. This councillor will complain and that neighborhood will have a problem, and they're not doing it. And those cities are going to really, they're going to become the next Detroit. They're going to bottom out before it gets better. And the lesson learned from Detroit is don't bottom out. It's see your decline and then jump to the recovery without going bankrupt in the middle.
When I feel like the, if you went back a little bit in time, the way that specifically American, probably Canadian cities would regenerate would be, let's spend the best part of $1 billion on an arena. And I think there's actually examples of this where it worked. Like, I think Edmonton is a very good example of this. Like, I can debate how the arena was funded until the cows come home. Park that. But the arena district in Edmonton, I think, is a great example of regenerating what was a really sad downtown.
Yeah.
But there's other examples where the arena's gone in. Sometimes it's not gone in the downtown. Sometimes it's gone in the suburbs. And maybe Ottawa is a good example of this. Now Ottawa is doing the sort of, let's bring the hockey arena back downtown, needed to revitalize. To me, this is the, you can do a lot more with hockey arena or sports stadium money in picking the key area or areas of your downtown and then using that to revitalize your existing assets to something else.
Yeah, absolutely. The kind of arena investment concept is interesting. It spurs growth. And in times of a recession at a city or country level, great. Flooded, you know, the city with $1 billion worth of construction and all of the jobs that come around that, manufacturing and so on. And then at the end of it, you have something that becomes a draw. That's great. A lot of cities, almost every city now that needs an arena has got one. But then what do you do? You know, what's the next thing? And I think you're right. It's figuring out where would you have built that arena today? And instead of building that, let's build something else or help build something else that is going to fund or inspire people to come back there.
All the repurposed assets that you've got end up funding the arena when you need an arena refresh or whatever it might be.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, some cities are still building huge arena projects for exactly the kind of urban regeneration reasons that we talk about. Atlanta just built one, DC's building one now. It's still, you know, it has an amazing impact, but it is a very focused impact, you know, a couple of nights a week kind of thing. And that much more complicated, much more difficult to achieve idea of an urban renewal impact instead is probably more valuable, but takes a hell of a lot more work to do it.
When you're doing this in a city where the model says this isn't really going to work, like it hasn't got the demand, it's going to be complicated as a building to refit to residential, is there more sort of thought that goes into at that point of what else could we do with this thing? Because I think there's like I always come back to a guy I interviewed a few episodes back on this, like doing Pearl in UCL in London, where effectively it's like a film set that's sort of a giant real world innovation lab plaything. But if you took a city where there's brutalist towers that are sitting empty, are there other things that you can go and do with those buildings that are not necessarily doing the commercial to residential conversion?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, honestly, the most simple thing is, and this is what we advise our clients a lot, look at a building. If it doesn't work for conversion, just move on and look at the one down the street.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not talking about converting every office. We're probably talking about, in most cities, about 10% of them. So if a project doesn't work, leave it as an office, go look at the next one. And if you start to do that, and, you know, again, Calgary's doing this well, if you start converting some of the office buildings, the ones that work really well, the other ones start to become more viable because mm-hmm. there is less office space. So demand starts to go up a little bit. Calgary's been smart about making sure the developers of these conversion projects actually focus on moving whatever tenants they had left into other offices in the neighborhood, which is, you know, makes pretty sense. Smart. Yeah. So instead of there being two 50% off, 50% vacant buildings next to each other, there's now 100% residential one and 100% office one. Great. You know, really, really clever. So I think that is part of it. Reduce the amount of vacant office, increase the demand for the rest, increase housing. But there are other office or other uses for these office buildings. And we've been looking at conversion to medical, which is incredibly popular, especially in the US right now, as their medical demand for medical buildings increases. We've been looking at conversion to long-term care and to senior housing and to other uses for universities and other types of businesses downtown. Honestly, the residential one is still the most popular, and it's popular because it meets, in most cities, the demand for housing and the demand to reduce office and the demand to do that in a sustainable way. There are definitely other users and definitely other projects happening, but the vast majority of what we're going to see is going to be in cities that need housing and need less office.
Yeah. And in terms of how that impacts the dynamic of the city, I feel like you have this thing at the moment where a lot of the time residential in a downtown ends up becoming designed for the single person or young couple or the older couple who might be downsizing and moving back downtown. But you lose the bit in the middle. Whereas if you look in the European context, you'll get more larger apartments that people can raise a family in. There's a park nearby, and it keeps the downtown or the city center more vibrant in terms of you have a more diverse, more resilient collection of people. You'll have schools and things like that. Are you seeing that these developments can be more varied in terms of the types of units they can put inside, and then that impacts all the other things around them?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the bigger office floor plates suit larger apartments much more easily, and therefore you are getting some more family-sized ones. In some cities, the real demand in the downtown is for affordable housing. So then you're seeing smaller units or shared units as well. To me, we can kind of debate it forever. Yes, cities should have space for everyone in them, but in a lot of places, we see that actually getting in the way of producing any housing at all. And that's a great shame, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been a lot about it recently. I was just starting to listen to an Ezra Klein podcast about building abundance. And it's like, you know, let's not stop a project from happening because we want these large units. Let's build the housing. Someone's going to live there. And if we get that right and the cities start to work, then we can build the schools and we can build the family housing. But like, let's stop letting perfect get in the way of like actually achieving anything.
I like the phrase, like, how can we be more interestingly less wrong?
Yeah. This is a very British thing, but I was watching University Challenge last night, which I'm sure no one who listens to your podcast is going to understand.
You'd be surprised.
Okay.
Weirdly, the fourth most popular country for listening to this podcast is Greece. I don't think University Challenge is a thing there, but...
No.
Yeah, this isn't all North American.
So there was a question on there about the early days of AI back in the 80s, and there was a model built called PAC, and it was like probably... I can't remember the exact acronym. It's like probably actually correct, but it was so interesting to me because it was like, oh, it's like probably close enough. Like we're getting towards being right. And I think that's so clever. It's like, okay, do we have to be totally right? Or do we have to be like pretty much correct and moving in the right direction?
I'm trying to look that up now to see what it actually is. Is it actually probably actually correct?
That sounds too definite. It was like less definite than that.
But like I write about this a lot in my innovation stuff, but like people are often scared of being wrong. So you spend all this time like seeking for a perfect and correct answer, or a singularly correct answer, but actually there's no such thing.
No, there's not. And I have this thing when I was starting to build a studio here at Gansler and trying to create something, I quickly realized that if I didn't make a decision, I was wrong 100% of the time. Quite often decisions are more nuanced than this, but like if you don't decide, you haven't got a chance of being right. Even if I'm terrible at what I'm doing and I decide every time, I'm 50% right. Just on average, I'm going to be better than if I don't make a decision. Like a lot of cities are in that position right now where they're not making the decision to move forwards. They are, you know, pushing it out or trying to do a study or blaming other people for it, and therefore are wrong all of the time. And I need to start seeing people moving against that.
How do you nudge them in the right direction? I think as a services firm, it's very hard to sort of do this sometimes, because sometimes you're the ones that will get blamed and you're concerned about your reputation and you don't want to upset somebody as an individual or as an organization. But like, how do you nudge them towards the, guys, I don't know if this is going to be the right thing to do, but it's going to be better than what we're doing right now.
Yeah, actually, it's super interesting. We hadn't been doing a lot of this city support and policy work until quite recently. And what I've found, and the reason why we've been hired to do it a lot, is that we can go in and be truthful and give them information. And if you can walk in to a city hearing or a community meeting and say, here's the real information, here's the facts, truthfully, not mm-hmm. my opinion, not my political bias, you know, which we all have, but if I can walk in and say, if you did this, you will get this. Here's the maths. We've done the maths. We've done the study. We've looked at the buildings. We've had consulting firms run the numbers. Then they will make the decision. And I found a lot of the time, it's really that lack of clear information that is preventing cities from moving forwards. They're getting lobbying, they're getting bias, they're getting just made up stuff, opinion. What they're not getting is enough facts. So that's what's made us popular in this, and I think made us successful in the cities that we've worked in, is that ability to go in and say, hey, what do you need? And most of the cities will say, well, we don't really know, but you know, Calgary said, well, we need less office, we need more housing. So I was like, oh, great, I can figure that out. You've set me a challenge.
You've got a tight brief.
And I can give you an answer. Yeah, it's a brief. You know, and a design always works on a brief. So then you can go back and say, if you want to get rid of 6 million square feet of office, you need a $75 a square foot incentive program. That, going to Calgary and saying that, they turned around and said, oh, great, we'll make a policy on that. And they had a policy in 3 months. You know, and they had housing being created within a year. That movement towards just actually fact-based politics, it feels like, you know, big picture, we're moving away from that. But actually on a city level, on a local level, I think we're moving towards it, because they want to be able to create action. And they can do that much better when someone tells them, here's the information, go make your political decision. I'm not going to get involved in the politics of it, but I will get involved in saying, if you want housing, do this thing.
So in the grand scheme of things, like, you've not actually been doing this all that long. It's bearing quite a lot of fruit. Where do you think this will be in 10, 20 years time?
Honestly, I think we're already starting to see, specifically the conversion stuff, we're already starting to see that being, you know, a ball rolling down the hill. I've been talking about this for 5 years, and people didn't want to hear it 5 years ago. They were all convinced that everything was going to be fine. Then 2 years ago, everyone wanted to know about it. And now it's becoming part of the common. People know about it. The public know about it. Politicians know about it. Everyone understands that it's a thing. And now it's started to happen. It's, you know, it's gained its own momentum. It's gained its own critical mass. So I think, honestly, in 5 years from now, there'll just be lots of these projects under construction. 10 years from now, it won't be anything that people care to talk about anymore, because it'll be just as normal as anything else that we do. And I'm really happy with that. I mean, I love the idea that you can create something, cities can create something, we can create something, and it just becomes so commonplace that people don't care about it anymore after a while. And it's a weird thing to say, but like, you know, you build something, you let it out into the wild, and then you move on with your life. And that's it's been my mantra for a lot of the innovation stuff I've been working on, but it's definitely true here.
Do you have the next thing that you're now the lone misfit starting to talk about and being like, guys, this is the next thing to care about, but you haven't, that there's more to go on it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, 5 years ago when I started the idea of putting this algorithm together, I put together a strategic plan for the studio I was running, and there was five things I was going to look at, and only one of them was good. The other four were terrible, or turned out to be terrible. I thought they were great at the time, but I like went out and showed them to clients. We tried to get some projects moving. It didn't happen. So I always like to have four or five things on the go. And for me, there's two next ones, and one of them I'm not even sure I'll be able to solve. But that, what do you do with dying cities, and what can you do to create vibrancy in a downtown where it's gone?
Mm-hmm.
Right now I'm like gathering the data and looking at it and trying, you know, speaking to a bunch of interesting people and getting their opinions. Will it turn into anything? Right now it feels impossible, but like it should. That should happen, and therefore we should be able to make it happen.
That's one I'd like to have many beers with you about.
Yeah, exactly. It's that thing where you can go, like, everyone wants to talk about it, but no one has a good idea yet. So I just need to meet the right person with the right good idea and still remember it after a few drinks.
This is why you record your beer conversations.
Yeah, I'm always, you know, whenever I'm talking to people, and you might have been to me while we're doing this, but I'm like, huh. And then I'll just like make a little note on my phone. And I have this like endless list of things that might may or may not be interesting at some point. I think that's critical. That's a problem I'd like to solve. And I now have a decent network of people who are working in that world, from like different think tanks and nonprofits, and from the work I did with the previous White House, a lot of connections at pretty high senior level in US politics. We're all trying to do that. So I think that's interesting. One of the other things I'm looking at is reviving something I'd been working on pre-COVID, which is when I was doing a lot of work with Sidewalk Labs and the Google team in Toronto. And we got really close to being able to build prefabricated mass timber net zero communities. We were like nearly there when COVID happened, and you know, the stuff happened with Dan Doktoroff. And the movement now is going back towards that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's doing it for a few reasons. Some places are doubling down on this net zero sustainable thing, but also other places, other clients, other governments are doubling down on manufacturing. They're doubling down on sourcing materials locally. And the solution, you know, that kind of idea of net zero prefabrication is locally manufactured, is locally sourced timber. It is creating jobs in industry and creating a kind of intelligence around construction. And it is creating things that are more efficient and cost less and are easier to do and more modern. So for the right or wrong reasons, in some cases, there is a movement back towards doing that. So you know, we've picked that up again, and we're looking at it with some major clients at the moment. And I think that in, you know, 2 years' time, 5 years' time, that is going to really have legs, and you'll start to see really high quality projects delivered in that way, in a way they haven't been before. Yeah, that's my two favorite ideas. God knows if they'll pan out. But
the thing I like to end these interviews on is by saying, if you had a magic wand, forget the constraints and the stresses, maybe in relation to those couple of things. If you had a magic wand, what would your wish or your command be with the magic wand? Perhaps to make those things happen.
It's, yeah. I mean, I'd need several magic wands, I think. I think actually what we need, if I could change one thing, and I think what we actually need probably to help reinvigorate our cities and construction particularly, which obviously I'm focused on, is this move towards all of us being excited by the new again. And I think we've all lost that a little bit, but what is it that we can do that gets everyone excited for the next generation of our downtown, for the next generation of design and building? So if I could wave a magic wand, I'd have everyone wake up tomorrow and be like, oh, you know what's really cool is this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be great if our downtown was completely different and better, rather than being a little conservative about it? So I think that would solve a lot of the problems. It, you know, I could say, well, everyone, Magic Wand and everyone's building with Mass Timber tomorrow. But actually, I think that's one part of it. If you could change from a conservative attitude to zoning and policy and all that kind of stuff to a really proactive, engaged, excited attitude, it would change everything.
I think there's like really interesting bits of cities that do, they kind of have the place where that's the bit of the city that is the sort of window into the future.
Yeah.
But I was reading a thing the other day about, I used to think Bankside was this in London. Like if I went back 10, 12 years ago, like everything happened around the Tate Modern was like kind of, that was the interesting little pocket and window. You saw it reflected in television shows where often things that were around a law firm or a banker or a high-flying office, it was always filmed in the Bluefin building. And I went to go see a client there a lot at the time. And then now you see a lot of stuff in that area. I think like there's an issue with the Tate Modern impinging on people's like windows or like viewing. And there was a thing of like they built another building next to a modern apartment building and like the couple's having a lawsuit around they don't have enough natural light to read a book and they would like the tower across the street demolished. It's interesting how like that attitude of, to me, that was the area that was the window into the future. But now all the stories of that area are about like, it's all the NIMBYism of the past.
Yeah. Yeah. It's infuriating when you start to see stuff like that. Cause it's, you know, a lot of the people who start complaining about it are the people that caused it to happen in the first place, you know. They moved there, made it a cool neighborhood, and they're like, well, I don't want anyone else here. This is my thing. Come on, move somewhere else. Move to the next cool place.
Yeah.
I love, when I was a kid, I used to love going to Camden, which was like the dirtiest, grimiest mess of a neighborhood. And you go back there now, and those kind of like weird street food places are now really cool restaurants.
Yeah.
The market has completely changed. The housing's completely changed. But it changed out of all these people who were there at the time trying to create something cool and being like super interested in their little, you know, their little store, their little, you know, street food stand, their little restaurant. And now it has grown into this huge, desirable neighborhood. And I hope that's fine. Now, those people who, well, not those people, they're those people's kids who are creating that cool thing should go do it somewhere else and create another new cool thing.
You kind of had it with Camden, Shoreditch, Dalston. I don't really know where it is now.
Yeah, Brixton, like, Shoreditch was the same. It was like such a dive, and Brick Lane was, you know, a mess. And now it has like some of the best restaurants in the world. Yeah, because there were some people there who thought it was a cool idea to do a really interesting restaurant, and they managed to drag it out of nothing into being the best, you know, some of the best restaurants in the world. That happens somewhere else next.
If you do that in the North American context, New York's obviously had that a lot with its different neighborhoods. That's the sort of thing that cities like a Toronto or even an LA don't necessarily, it doesn't move quite as quickly. I don't know what it is, but if you can get North American cities to kind of have that ability to go and play around, that you get lots of good stuff come out that way.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, I live in between Roncesvalles and Parkdale, and Parkdale had that vibe when I first moved there. It was like, there's some really interesting stuff happening here, some new cool new stores and restaurants and stuff. And it kind of got flattened. Like it was kind of not allowed to happen just when it was starting to. It was kind of pushed down because they wouldn't let development happen. They wouldn't let new types of retail and new types of restaurants go in. And they tried to limit the number of restaurants that were allowed. You know, and they tried to limit the amount of development that was allowed, and it was like it was just getting its legs under it, and it got squashed. And I think it's a real shame that we do that. You know, we're trying to protect something that, you know, going back to what I said earlier, we're trying to protect something that's slowly getting worse because it's not being reinvested in. And I don't know why we do that. You know, we should at least maintain it as being as good as it was, and try and make it better for the people who live there, better for the people who want to live there. You know, so
it's kind of like having a kid. You got to let them grow up. You can't just, like, you don't want to keep them as a 12-year-old. They need to become a teenager, even if that's a bit gangly and awkward, but then they become an adult. Like, that's it's the same thing with cities, right?
Yeah, 100%. I feel like right now what we're doing with some of our neighborhoods in Toronto is trying to prevent them from growing up, but also like forcing them to wear the same clothes. And they're like busting at the seams with new things happening. It's like, you should probably buy that kid some new shoes. No, it'll be fine. his feet will shrink back down to the size they were before if we just don't pay attention to it.
I'm gonna make that my analogy. I'm gonna run with it. I'm gonna make that my magic one to end on of like more shoe shops.
Yeah, more shoe shop. I'm down with that.
Stephen, it's been a pleasure. To go on, but I really appreciate. Like, I feel like I do a lot of the rantiness and shoutiness, and there's loads of ideas. But it's like lovely to see that like the competent people knowing what to do to make up and make them real. So thanks for like spending some time with me.
Yeah, no problem. It's good fun to chat.
Thank you so much once again for listening to the entirety of one of these podcasts. This thing's kind of growing and moving a little bit, and it's fascinating to see where people are reading from, listening to this I don't know what I'm talking about. It's fascinating to see where all the people who listen to and read the write-ups of these conversations come from. It's genuinely all over Canada, the US, the UK. Weirdly, like I said in an episode, Greece. Don't know. If someone wants to recommend a great accidental Greek urbanist, please do put them in touch. Or just if you are one of those people, please do get in touch. These things really help when you like and share and comment, when you tell me what you like, when you tell me what you don't like, when you tell me who you would like to be interviewed in the future for these episodes. So we're coming towards the end of season 2. There's going to be a season 3. So if there's people you want to hear from, do recommend them and let me know. And thank you once again for listening. Have a good one. Bye.